Okay, great. So it's a real pleasure today to welcome Vasily Belokurov as our speaker today. So Vasily has done some of the most important work in recent years on our understanding of our galaxy and our local environment. So for example, so using deep imaging data from Sloan and from DES, he discovered a large number of faint satellites around the Milky Way, as well as the famous field of streams. He's even found satellites, from the past that have long since been disrupted, like the famous Gaia sausage. Vasily's also done some of the most important work on using tidal streams to understand our galaxy's dark matter halo as well. And so today, I believe that's what he's going to tell us about. So Vasily's talk is titled Stellar Streams in the Gaia Era. And so Vasily, please take it away, when you're ready.
Thanks very much, Neil. Thanks for inviting me, and thanks to you guys for attending this presentation. So let me share my screen. And now, hopefully you see my slides.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. So I'm going to talk about the stellar streams today, but you can see that I've put on my title slide this elephant in the room, and hopefully by the end of the presentation, you'll figure out, or maybe even now you have an inkling, what this elephant in the room is and why we should care about it. So I'll start with the Gaia mission, which is probably, to my heart, the most precious and the most exciting experiment going on right now. It's a space observatory that has just been extended for the same amount of time. It's just finished its nominal mission of 5 years, and it's been extended for a further 5 years. So it's going to collect more better data. In the end, the precision will be higher, right? And the mission of Gaia mission, is to put together the puzzle of the Milky Way, right? To understand the mass distribution of the Milky Way, hopefully probe gravity on a variety of scales, and understand how the dark matter is behaving and interacting with baryons in our galaxy. Also, map out the density of dark matter on the smallest scales we can hope to do so. And of course, the Milky Way is one of the best laboratories to do so on very small scales. And of course, by looking at the orbits of stars, we can try to unpick the formation scenarios that led to the way the Milky Way looks like now, right? So we hope that we can use the Gaia data, which is essentially a many-dimensional view of the stellar tracers in our galaxy, to understand the gravity and the evolution of the Milky Way. And normally, when we try to take the phase space distribution of some tracer particles, in this case stars, and then use it to infer the properties of the matter distribution, we need to make assumptions. And these assumptions involve sometimes symmetries or adiabatic slow changes. They normally invoke well-behaved density profiles, and they quite often, almost always, invoke equilibrium. But all these assumptions can actually, we realize, be broken in the case when we have the elephant in the room. We have some large, unaccounted for, and rapidly evolving non-axisymmetric mass component. And in that case, the whole task, the whole mission of the Gaia mission seems to be in peril, because we only know how to do it under these assumptions that I've just listed. So how do we, let's try to do it, and how do we typically do it, right? If we're interested in, say, distribution of dark matter on large scales, we know that we don't really get to observe the dark matter, it being invisible and all, but we have another halo occupying the same volume as the dark halo in our galaxy, and that's the stellar halo, right? So it's formed by a similar processes, right? It's the also a sequence of accretion of smaller galactic fragments, their disruption, and their virializing in the gravitational potential of our galaxy. So these two halos are linked. Importantly, the stellar halo is not contributing or any appreciable amount of mass, but it's it can be used as a tracer, right? We can use stars in the stellar halo to trace the dark matter. And of course, well, at these distances, at large distances, you can see that, you know, the Milky Way galaxy, the stellar component, the baryonic component only sits in the very inner parts of the gravitational potential, and the halo extends to distances that are order of magnitude larger. At these distances in the halo, the orbital periods are very long, and the mixing is very, very slow. So nothing is really mixed in the halo. And because of that, we have the remnant record of the accretion events that happened long ago in our galaxy. That's another beautiful thing about the halo. Right, so if you look at the stellar halo of a galaxy like Milky Way today, it looks like a beautiful mess. And this is one example of such beautiful mess from a numerical simulation of a stellar halo formation in which you are throwing small dwarf galaxies into the Milky Way. They disrupt, and the Milky Way takes over their stellar content and redistributes it throughout its virial volume. And so the color coding here is according to the which satellite, which star came from, right? So one color, one satellite, right? You can see that they're all mixed. However, even though it's very messy, you can see that you can roughly split the stellar halo into structures with different properties. You have something that looks broad, like a cloud or a shell of stellar debris. You also have thin and narrow arcs of stellar streams, right? And the two different structures arise because of the original properties, initial properties of the satellites, right? So shells and clouds form from satellites that are massive or on radial orbits. So they disrupt quickly, leaving these shells of material all over the place. And streams arise from a lower mass satellites, typically on slightly more tangential orbits, so on orbits with high angular momentum, and they disrupt slower, forming these long elongated structures. And of course, some objects do not come too close or have enough dark matter to keep them intact for long time, and so they survive as clumps of stars today. We can see them as clumps of stars today, and they're satellites that are intact. But all of this stellar halo is built from something that looked originally like this green cloud, right? So stellar halo is basically just dead bodies of satellite galaxies that are no more, that are disrupted and now phase mixing in the gravitational potential of the Milky Way. And so these different structures have different information content. For example, if we find some satellites, we can study how the structure formation proceeded at high redshift universe, you know, especially the baryonic physics, the stellar formation in a very different regime, right? And we can also place constraints on the low end of the dark matter subhalo mass function. So these are interesting targets for indirect dark matter searches as well. Streams, on the other hand, they are the galaxies that are not existing anymore. We don't have direct counterparts of these galaxies at redshift zero because they all disrupted and now are streams, right? They're probably also low mass galaxies in the past, but the streams are interesting for the purposes of studying those disrupted galaxies, but also they are very direct and very powerful probes of the gravitational potential of our galaxy today. And that's because streams delineate orbits of the satellites from which they come. So they are, and of course, orbits is probably having an orbit and interpreting and modeling an orbit is as direct a way of getting the mass within this orbit as can be, right? And we know it all from, for example, a beautiful measurement of the mass of a supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy, which has been carried out using orbits of stars that rotate very fast around around the supermassive black holes. Of course, there, the orbital periods are, say, a decade, 10 years, and in Halo, these orbital periods are billions of years, right? So we can't really wait to see any significant patch of the orbit. So streams do this for us, right? The streams have been forming for billions of years, and so that's why they're so useful. And then shells and clouds, they tell us about massive accretion events that happen probably in the early stages of our galaxy. For us, for the Milky Way, that's particularly true because we think that in the Milky Way, the accretion history peaked early and then stayed quiescent. So if we find any evidence or in the shape of shells and clouds, it's telling us something about very past massive mergers, alternatively mergers of objects on very radial orbits. And as Neil pointed out, we've experienced something of a dwarf satellite revolution, right? So the number of galactic satellites had been low for a while, for a half a century. We only had just under a dozen of dwarf satellites, and that's been a problem. And then with the advent of all sky digital surveys like Sloan, for example, suddenly we have found a whole bunch, and you can see that this graph is shooting up. So this graph of discoveries of dwarf galaxies is a function of year, right? It's shooting up through the roof now. We're finding more and more each year. Something similar is happening with streams, right? Streams are just same satellites, but in a very different phase state, right? So they are long and stretched satellites, if you will, right? And so now we're zooming in on the last 20 years, and you can see that we only started discovering stellar streams 20 years ago. And then with the arrival of new data covering large fraction of the sky, we have discovered now many tens of stellar streams from a variety of progenitors, from globular clusters to large satellite galaxies. So this is a first example of what the stellar halo in the Milky Way looks like for roughly one fifth of the whole sky. And you can see that it's far from being smooth. There are streams of different sizes and lengths here. So there's a very thin stream from a globular cluster. There's a very thick bifurcated stream from a dwarf galaxy. So because these two streams will be the focus of my talk, I've highlighted them here, right? The stream from the Sagittarius dwarf and the stream from unknown progenitor that we call an orphan stream, and it's crossing Sagittarius like so. DES is deeper and a better resolution sky survey, covering slightly smaller patch of the sky, but being somewhat superior to Sloan, it managed to provide data that in a very beautiful analysis led by Nora Shape, who was a graduate student at the time, discovered many, many new streams in a very small patch of the sky, right? So you see that in Sloan, we basically discovered a handful, and some of them were obvious to the eye. Here we've employed clever detection techniques and uncovered 20 streams, right? So an order of magnitude more. And then of course with Gaia, right? So now the whole sky is covered in pieces of stellar streams, right? This is work predominantly led by Rodrigo Ibata and Kayati Malan. You can see here multiple streams, many of which are new, right? You can see again the orphan stream. So this is now in galactic coordinates in LNB, right? So the previous plots were in equatorial axes are not even shown here. This is equatorial array and deck. This is the same, and this is now in galactic LNB, and so the Milky Way's plane is at B0, right, crossing this. And this is the same distribution of stars in the stellar streams, repeated twice. In one case, at the top, the stars are color-coded according to their distance, and at the bottom are color-coded according to their metallicity. You can see that metallicity is largely low. These are mainly small systems, right? We know that we have a beautiful correlation in the observable universe between the metallicity of the stellar system and its mass. And it's because the stellar feedback is independent of the mass of the stellar system, right? It's to do with the physics of supernova explosion. It's the same, but the ability to hold on to the gas that's now escaping from the system due to the supernova explosions depends on the mass, right? So the more massive the galaxy is, the more gas it will be able to hold on to or re-accrete and keep forming stars, right? And so as it keeps forming stars, it increases its metallicity, right? So all these systems, or the majority of them, are low metallicity, telling us that the galaxies or star clusters they come from are small mass stellar systems. You in the top, you can see the color coding is according to the distance from the sun, right? And most colors here are blue or light blue, maybe going into green, and only a couple are yellow. And yellow is only 20 kiloparsecs from the sun. So most of these new streams that we have been looking so far with Gaia are actually not so far out from the sun, right? So they're in the inner 20 kiloparsecs or so, and most of them are in the inner 10 kiloparsecs from the sun, right? So that's an important thing to note. And so we have lots of...
Is it surprising on that previous slide, you know, to find so many streams that are at such small galactocentric radii? Like, are the ages of these streams like known to be like recent or young, I guess?
It's not surprising. Well, I don't think it's so maybe you need to unpack this question for me. What do you mean the ages of the streams are known to be?
No. I mean, like, it was a question if they are like old streams or young streams. You know,
they are old streams.
Yeah,
the old streams and their surface brightnesses are extremely low because their phase mixing faster, right? Because orbital periods are shorter, mm-hmm. So the surface brightness is diluting quicker. That's why you needed Gaia to find them, right? So they're there, but their densities per square degree are incredibly low of the star stellar members. But maybe I'm not answering your question.
Yeah, well, you kind of are, I guess. I was just surprised, you know, that these things haven't completely phase mixed, you know, because the dynamical time is so short, you know, deep in the center of our halo.
Yes, so you're right, and of course, if you kind of assume that they're all on circular orbits, then yeah, that would be like they will be phase mixing very fast. But of course they're not, right? And some of them are on eccentric orbits, right? And then you have some time spending near the galactic center, and then a lot of time spending at the upper center. But you're right, the surface brightness of these structures is much lower than those we discovered before with the photometric surveys, right? And that's the beauty of Gaia, that even at these incredibly low surface brightness levels, we can identify structures that are, you know, stars that are moving together.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Yeah. And just, so I've convinced you that we have plenty of streams. And now just a quick reminder how streams form. And in this oversimplified picture, here's a satellite on an orbit whose center is somewhere underneath the screen. And imagine two Lagrange points where, you know, there is a balance of a centrifugal force and the gravity from the satellite and the host around which it's moving. And in this, if a star from the satellite approaches the Lagrange point, you know, there are good reasons why it might happen. But if it finds itself near this aperture, which is the kind of near the Lagrange or inner or outer point, it can choose essentially, right, to either stay in the satellite or leave the satellite and start orbiting in the host potential, right? Because it's finding this point of equilibrium, and if it's perturbed away or has enough energy, for example, to go out of that tidal radius, it can now move freely in the host potential of the bigger galaxy, right? And so if we assume that this diffusion of stars happens through these two openings, the inner Lagrange and the outer Lagrange, immediately you would notice that there'll be an offset in energy and angular momentum or between the stars leaving through the outer Lagrange, the satellite, and the stars leaving through the inner Lagrange, right? So the outer Lagrange, the stars will have high energies and high angular momentum, and conversely, inner Lagrange point, low energy, low angular momentum. So what it means is that the orbital periods will be different, right? And then now what takes over is just phase mixing, right? So they have some offset in terms of the energy and angular momentum with respect to the progenitor. And these changes, small differences in the orbital frequency will now grow and accumulate in large differences in orbital phase. Right, and so the streams will grow if you wait long enough. Right, that's basically just the process of phase mixing over a very, very long time, and you will form a trailing arm and a leading arm. And here's a very simplistic, oversimplified cartoon that shows this. Right, so here's an object moving on some orbit in a gravitational potential, and I'm releasing two clouds from Lagrange one and Lagrange two. Of stars or particles with some velocity dispersion. And you see that due to phase mixing, right, the differences in the orbital periods accumulate and they form these beautiful, very long tails. And the most important thing why we love streams is that these streams delineate orbits. They're not exactly orbits, and I'll explain why, but they delineate orbits. Streams, of course, are not structures per se. They are just, they're really illusions of structures. There's nothing that's holding streams together. They're just stars moving on very similar orbits. That's all. They don't know about each other. There's nothing that's telling them about each other's presence. So what that means is that streams are extremely fragile, right? So there's nothing, there's no self-gravity of any sort to keep them together. So it's very easy to start perturbing this, right? So on the other hand, so first, they're telling us about underlying matter distribution. Second, they're easy to perturb, right? So why they're not orbits? Here's a demonstration of what happens with the energy and the angular momentum of stars in a satellite, right? So on the right-hand side, you can see the satellite moving on orbit, right? This is X and Y in the orbital plane around some galaxy. On the left-hand side, you see energy and angular momentum with respect to the progenitor. So the progenitor's energy and angular momentum are subtracted. And you can see, first of all, it's changing all the time. Well, yes, because the gravitational potential that the stars feel is not constant, right? This gravitational potential is constantly evolving because the satellite is moving on an eccentric orbit inside the host, right? So the combined gravitational potential is constantly changing. And you can see that the distribution of energy and angular momentum is changing shape and elongation in this space. And it is really this angle of elongation is just the current position of the progenitor over current velocity of the progenitor in the space of delta L versus delta E, right? So it's very steep at the upper center when it's moving slowly, and then it's so R over V is large, and then it's very shallow at the peri where the R is small and V is large, right? And so you can see that from the ends of this evolving, constantly rotating and stretching and compressing distribution, or on the edges of this ellipse, you're chopping off stars that become unbound, right? And once they're unbound, they're frozen, right? Now, these stars are living in the fixed gravitational potential of the host. And so their positions in the energy and angular momentum space are fixed, right? You can see that, interestingly, these stars that have been removed from the progenitor, they have a range of energies, right? So there's an offset from the progenitors distribution, and you can see that there is a particular shape. It's like a bow tie structure. And what this bow tie structure is also telling you is that almost no stars are actually unbound at either peri or upper. You can see that when it rotates to peri, there are very few stars in those bow ties fragments. And similarly, when it rotates to upper, there are very few stars that were stripped then, right? But you create this bow tie, and so you can see that the stream will be composed from stars with a range of, actually non-trivial range of ellipticities, energies and angular momentum. So that's why streams are not, one reason why streams are not exactly orbit. So if you want to model and interpret them, you need to take this into account. So that's just a summary of what happens in the energy angular momentum space, how this bow tie structure forms, swinging through peri, swinging through apo, and then stars at the ends of the ellipse are chopped off, and then they're frozen in the energy angular momentum space, right? In this case, energy and angular momentum are all integrals of motion, and that's because we had an axisymmetric galaxy. Well, in this case, it must be a spherical galaxy because the L is conserved here, right? And second, so right, so important thing, if you can model a stream, if you can get over this bit of complexity to do with the initial conditions for your stars in the stream that are slightly non-trivial due to this interesting shape in the space of integrals of motion, you can model the gravitational potential. That's exciting. And then the second thing, they are fragile, and so they're sensitive to perturbations. Even low mass perturbers can cause quite a bit of havoc in the stream, right? And so you can imagine the dark matter halo passing through a stream, which is depicted here as a train of particles, right? And then all particles will acquire a velocity kick, which will depend, of course, on the velocity with which the with which this dark matter subhalo is passing by, this perturber is passing with on its mass. And of course, there will be a degeneracy, right? So you can see already that the velocity kick depends on the ratio of mass to the velocity. And so that's a degeneracy that we have to deal with, and the distance from the impact point, right? And so the velocity kick as a function of distance away from the closest approach to the stream of this perturber is shown on the right, right? And you can see that it drops to zero at the very small distances, and that's because there is, you know, if you assume that this dark matter perturber has some density distribution at small distances, there's not enough mass to give you a strong kick, and at large distances it also goes to zero, right, because the gravity falls off, right? So there's some peak velocity kick that stars acquire, and once they've acquired this velocity kick, again the same process starts to happen, which is just phase mixing, right? So you just gave an impulse to this, some the stars in the stream. The only point here is that that kick will be a function of distance from the impact point, and they start to relax, right? And so they start to relax, and here's this, an evolution of the stream properties as a function of time after it's been kicked, right? After, you know, an intruder, a perturber, passed by the stream, right? It gives the stars near the impact point a velocity kick, and they start to, the orbits start to evolve, right? So they start to move away from the impact point. First, they momentarily attract it to the mass, right? That makes sense. They attract it to the mass, and they kind of want to move to it, but of course, nothing is stationary in space. This whole train was moving already, right? So what it means is that the stars that are getting additional velocity with a minus or plus sign with respect to the original stream velocity, the orbits will change correspondingly. And normally what it leads to is that they will reverse their motions from moving towards the perturber very quickly to moving away from the impact point, because the orbital periods are now different. And so they will be either leading or trailing, very similarly to, it's the same mechanics as how the streams form. And so the stars that are kicked now will move away and open a gap, right? So these gaps and stream perturbations, you can see that there is not only a density perturbation, a depletion of the stream's density, there is also a curvature to the stream. There will also be a velocity signature, right? So all phase space dimensions are perturbed. And typically for the 10 to the 8 solar mass perturber, you expect 1 or 2 kilometers a second perturbation of the stream and a few degrees gap opening after a few giga years if you wait. So that's to tell you the roughly the scale, right? So if you can go sub-kilometer a second in precision and can measure density fluctuations on the scales of smaller than degrees, you are in principle sensitive to perturbers with masses lower than 10 to the 7, maybe even 10 to the 6 solar masses. This is, of course, not the only way to perturb the stream. You can actually do a lot more damage. You can have much more drastic perturbations. And here's one demonstrated in this movie created by Dennis Erkel, who's been leading a lot of the analysis of the stream perturbations in the last years, both theoretical and observational as well, and modeling. And you can see that the energy angular momentum space, which is shown on the right-hand side, gets very stretched, perturbed, and completely mangled when the big subhalo falls into the host, right? So there is a giant guy when it's coming. I mean, it's difficult to see here because some of the orbital evolution is happening in 3D and we see them in projection, excuse me. But when it comes close enough, it not only changes drastically the gravity, so there has been an interaction here, but now it's coming really close to the host. What happens, it's adding mass, but it's also pulling the host. The host halo itself is now moving in reflex motion, responding to the infall of this massive thing. So interactions like this, when a substantial merger is happening, not really a small satellite, but you know, a significant fraction of a mass of the host is dumped, right? Then the streams can be perturbed very, very drastically. So why are we focusing today and in the last couple of years, why have we focused on on these two streams, Orphan and Sagittarius? Well, there are two good reasons. Well, first of all, they are the most luminous, the longest structures we see in the Milky Way today. And so we have lots of tracers to work with. And let me show you just one pretty cool visualizations of the streams in the Milky Way. So this is a visualization created by Adrian Price Willen, and you can see the Milky Way represented by this beautiful spiral, and the yellow dot is the position of the sun. So let me just show you some of the streams that we are we've discovered recently. If I zoom out a bit, right, so you can see them in 3D. Some of these are Gaia streams, right? And so now if I add the Orphan and the Sagittarius stream, you can see the another very good reason to try to model these two structures. They are gigantic, right? So they're probing very, very large range of distances in the Milky Way. Also, you see that their orbits are not aligned. So they're giving us, if we can one day model them simultaneously, they will give us complementary information on the shape of the Milky Way dark matter halo. But you can see they primarily, we are modeling and interpreting these two streams because they cover a very wide range of galactocentric distances. And you can already see that something is not exactly right with the with both of them. You can see that the Orphan stream is a bit bent, right? So it's not staying in one plane. You have to imagine that It has to stay more or less in the plane going through the center of the Milky Way, but you can see that it's tilted and twisted. And if you kind of try to align Milky Way and the Sagittarius stream as well, you notice a small twist and a tilt in Sag debris too, right? So the distances to which the orphan stream goes out from the galactic center is a order of 60 kiloparsecs. Here you see Sagittarius debris going to 60 or so, but there is a continuation of the trailing tail of the Sag of the Sagittarius stream that goes even beyond that, goes to 100 kiloparsecs or so, right? So the trailing is this angle, is this tail, this one, right? So at its upper, it's at around 100 kpc from the galactic center. Right, so that's the reason we are focusing on these two structures. And the second reason is that we have tried multiple times to model Sagittarius and Orphan, and these attempts have been not very successful. In particular for the Sagittarius stream, we have come to a very different conclusions with respect to the properties of the Milky Way's dark matter halo. So the orphan stream analysis is based on the two recent papers, one led by Sergei Kopasev, the observational one, and the second one, the modeling is based on the paper by Denis Erkel, who I already mentioned, who's done quite a lot of work in analyzing the stream perturbations. Here's the orphan stream, or when you look at it with the Gaia Data Release 2 data. And here we are using a particular set of tracers that actually simplifies matters quite significantly. We're just looking at the R Lyra stars, and R Lyra stars are beautiful because they're standard candles, right? The range of absolute magnitudes for R Lyra is very small, and you can even improve on that by measuring their periods, but that's not strictly speaking necessary to have a good idea, you know, within 10% of the distance of the R Lyra star. And so when you plot R Lyra stars in the inner parts, well, within 50 kiloparsecs or so from the galactic center, it's very easy to pick up one very elongated structure that is piercing the Milky Way from north to south. This arc here is the orphan stream. And so the curious thing is that until Gaia Data Release 2, we only knew half of the stream. Well, we thought we knew only half of the stream, and that was the northern part of the stream that was detected by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. In one of the first images I showed you in this field of stream image, you could see it, right? And the southern part was completely unknown. So first of all, Gaia allowed us to connect the pieces together and notice that orphan stream is a very long elongated structure, which we now have doubled its length in the Milky Way. Thanks to Gaia, you now have five out of six phase space dimensions of these stream stars. And what I'm showing you here are the properties of this stream in a coordinate system that is now aligned with the stream, right? So the phi one is now angular measure that's running along the stream. So I've aligned my equatorial celestial coordinate system with the stream, right? So, and then the stream is moving a lot. The stream stars are distributed over large angular distances along phi one, you see from minus 100 to plus 100 degrees, but very small amount of displacement in phi two, right? That's the angular distance from the equator of this new coordinate system, or from this.
Can I ask you a question?
Why
don't we have a line of sight velocity? I thought Gaia also measured that as well.
Yes, so Gaia measures line of sight velocity, but of course it's much more expensive measurement, right? So you need a lot more photons to disperse them into a spectrum. So you can only reliably do it. And of course, Guy measures everything. Everything is projected simultaneously on the focal plane, right? So it's difficult to unpick. So Guy can only do it reliably for very bright stars. So the brightest of the stars, so it's a very small fraction of the total number of stars Guy measures. So Guy measures, say, 1.5 billion stars, distances and proper motions, and only 10 million or so at the moment, the brightest ones have radial velocities. So that's why we don't get radial velocities. Radial velocities are very expensive and cumbersome, unfortunately. And so most of these stars are faint enough. They don't enter there, that selection.
So there's no other observatory that measures radial velocity for these guys?
No. Of course. But the density on the sky, it's one star per square degree. So it's very expensive, right? So if you want to map out 200 square degrees, you have to go and measure star by star. So it takes time. So of course, I'm sure there are now surveys of large spectroscopic surveys coming online, like DESI, like WEAVE, and in a couple of years, Foremost, they will take large amounts of spectroscopic data. And so many of these streams will have their missing coordinates measured, right? So the line of sight velocities. But at the moment, we are kind of make do with just 5D, but that's fine. Right? You can do a lot with 5D. So, yeah. So,
yeah, you know, like, also, can I ask something?
So,
phi equals zero, there is like a deficit of stars. Like, why?
Yeah, there are no stars. I mean, we essentially phi one equals zero. We put it more or less in the Milky Way's disk plane, right? So where we have we wouldn't be able to easily see the stream stars there anyway. So if I showed you this image again, right? So you can see that this gap in the stream density is more or less where it's crossing the Milky Way's plane. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. I see.
So that's just by choice. That's what we that's where we decided to put phi 1 0. That's all. So, but yes, there it's a little bit tricky to find the stream stars. It's not clear what's going on there at the moment. It could be a real depletion or not, but just bear in mind that that's where the Milky Way's disk is. Phi one along the stream, phi two perpendicular, and then you can look at other properties as a function of phi one as well, right? So for example, you can look at the distances of the stars. You can look at the proper motion in right ascension and declination, but perhaps more interestingly, you can look at the proper motion in the coordinate system aligned with the stream, right? So proper motion along phi one and proper motion along phi two, right? So this motion in tangential direction on the plane of the sky along the stream and perpendicular to the stream is only physically meaningful if you subtract the reflex motion of the sun. That therefore it's very important that you have accurate distances to the stars so you can correct for the reflex motion of the sun and actually see the true motion of the stars in the stream. And of course, for the stream to be a stream, its phi two proper motion, so proper motion perpendicular to the stream, should be close to zero, right? That otherwise, the stars in the stream will be moving away from the stream, and the stream won't stay the stream for much longer. It's like, you know, if you have a train of carriages moving on the rail track, the carriages have to move along one path. If they start moving sideways, it's not going to be a train anymore, right? So you can see immediately that mu phi 2 is close to zero in the northern part of the stream, so phi 1 positive above the disk is the northern part of the stream, but significantly off in the southern part, right? So there is a significant non-zero component of tangential motion in this stream. And that was a shock, right? So you can view it in a slightly different way. Here in the top panel, I'm showing you the stream track, so where the stars are, and it's curved. And there are different reasons for it to be curved, right? Even in the potential that is stationary, right? This curvature, of course, notice it's not huge, right? Because there are only a couple of degrees in phi 2 over, 200 degrees of phi 1. So there is some curvature. But the most important thing is that if you now plot the direction of motions of stars in each section of the stream, they're shown by the gray arrows. They are not moving always as you would predict, right? Again, in the southern part, they are moving perpendicular to the stream. That is bizarre. Right, so it means that, but also notice that it's not some random motion. The whole section of the stream, the whole basically southern part of the stream, is now being dragged away from the direction of motion of the stream. So you can also look at it in a different way. You can plot the direction of the motion of the stars in the stream by looking at the stream itself, and that's shown by the red dashed line in the bottom panel, right? That's just d phi 2 over d phi 1. And you can also take a ratio of proper motions, and that's mu phi 2 over mu phi 1. And you can see that there's a huge mismatch between the two directions of motion and direction of stream, right? So the stream and the stream motion are completely misaligned for a whole half of the stream, right? It's everything is more or less okay in the north. There is good alignment there, but in the south, there is a huge mismatch. And this is impossible to facilitate in the gravitational potential that is non-evolving, right? In the fixed gravitational potential, you cannot have a component of the force that will move the stream stars sideways, right? And that is striking. So when we first saw it, we said, well, okay, maybe the gravitational potential is, we just don't understand the property of the gravitational potential. There's something going on. Let's try to model the stream. And of course, what we tried to do is to model a portion of the stream which we saw before in the SDSS data, some 10, 15 years ago. And that's the portion at positive phi 1, that's this bit here in the north, right? And you can see that each panel gives you a different phase space coordinate or position on the sky, distance, proper motion alpha, proper motion delta. And then the bottom panel, we have some velocities, line of sight velocities, not for the RLIR, but for other stars in the stream. We're not modeling them now, but we're just showing them as red data points just to guide the eye. So you can see you can have a model of the stream that goes through the data, stationary Milky Way blue curve, right? And you already guess what's happening here. This stationary Milky Way doesn't have a large massive satellite falling in, and this large massive satellite is the LMC. So now you have a stationary Milky Way, you fit the data in the north, it's fine. When you go to the south, there is a huge mismatch between the data and the model. Right, so this model cannot explain both the north and the south. And that the reason for that, of course, as I just explained, is because the stars in the south have extra velocity component perpendicular to the stream, which cannot happen in the fixed gravitational potential. The moment you add a Large Magellanic Cloud, the LMC, into the picture, just it's a trial. That's not an attempt to fit or to model. It's just an example, right? So the moment you just take the orbital properties of the LMC and add a mass there and evolve them together, the stream and the LMC, you get the orange curve, right? And that's with the LMC of a pretty large mass. And interestingly, what it does, it doesn't change much the stream behavior in the north, right? It's more or less the same, but in the south, it brings the model into the agreement with the data. Now the orange dotted curve goes through the data in the south and in the north. So Of course, what we did is that we've incorporated the LMC into our stream model. And so here the data is shown with black data symbols, and the realization from our stream model is shown as in blue. And you can see now we have a model that goes through most of the data. And the model now, the behavior of the model is shown in the top panel, where we not only showing you where the how the stream bends on the sky, you can see that it's doing the same kind of bending as our data is telling us, and there is some curvature to the stream, right? But also, you see that the model has a component of motion in the south that is misaligned with the stream. And this misalignment is solely to do with infalling massive satellite, which is the LMC. And you can see here that we now can go through the data points in the stream orientation track that I showed you earlier. And now you want to say, what are these stars that are so deflected and being dragged in a direction perpendicular to their original motion? And the bottom panel here illustrates what the stars are. The bottom panel shows, as a function of phi 1, minimal approach of each star to the Large Magellanic Cloud, right? And that's a log scale on the y-axis, right? So it's 10 kiloparsecs at the bottom and 100 kiloparsecs at the top. And you can see that the stars that are most deflected, that are showing this mismatch between motion and direction of the stream, are the stars that are experiencing the closest approach to the LMC. And these are the stars that are most deflected by the LMC. So essentially, all that happens is that the LMC so it comes in and deflects a portion of the stream, right? So you can see that the progenitor is disrupting in our model. And then this intruder galaxy comes, the LMC, and it pulls the bottom part of the stream here, the southern part of the stream, away from its orbital plane, from its direction of the original motion. You can see that this model of the stream goes through the data, and you can see now also where the orbit was, right? That's the dashed line, and where the stream got deflected by the passage of the LMC. Because this is such a striking effect, and because also we have a portion of the stream that is not affected, we can very reliably and very accurately measure the total mass of the of this dwarf galaxy, of the Large Magellanic Cloud, right? Because we have a gigantic signature in velocity and in the angular position of the stream stars, right? And so this is very different from a small perturbation that I talked to you about, when you know you just deflect some stars and then there some gap starts to grow. This the half of the stream's just been dragged away, right? And this is such a striking effect. So this is really the only, I would say, measurement of the total mass of any galaxy, right? So you know, guys, that it's very difficult to measure total mass of any galaxy, right? And the reason for that is because there are no tracers that can probe the mass distribution at very large distances from the galaxy center, right? So we know the typical total masses of galaxies because we can do weak lensing, but those masses are for an ensemble of galaxies that was selected for on some property. It's very difficult or impossible in astronomy to actually measure a total mass of any galaxy right out and beyond its spherical radius. But here, the whole dark matter halo of the LMC has been doing the deflection of something that is quite far away from it, right? I mean, the closest stars come, you know, to within 10, 15 kiloparsecs, but it's also bending stars that are 20 and 30 kiloparsecs from the LMC, right? So it's a, I think it's a very exciting and first measurement of total mass of a single galaxy.
Yeah, so this mass is huge.
It is huge. And yeah, and that's what I'm trying to say. Look at the mass in the Milky Way at the same position, right? So here's the a compilation of masses of the Milky Way at different apertures, right? So you're going from the center of the Milky Way and galactocentric radius, this is log scale, and you're calculating cumulative mass, right? So here's the curve of growth, and you can see that at the position of the LMC, right, it's roughly 2, 3, Well, between 3 and 4 × 10^11, and we measured 1.5 × 10^11. It's half of the Milky Way's mass within the same aperture, right? It's not a small satellite coming in. It's a giant perturber, right? That is only, you know, it's the if you just look at the mass within the orbit of the LMC, it's the mass ratio is 1/2. So it is not a small thing at all. You're right, Neil.
So in your modeling, can I ask, like, you know, so in your modeling, do you treat the LMC as some like fixed object, or is it also being treated, you know, via, via particles of its own in a live simulation?
Right. That's the question that we've all been asking, and our colleagues in different groups been investigating this. This particular calculation is done. Right, so there is an MCMC chain, and it's done, you know, over a large range of parameters of the Milky Way, LMC, the orphan streams properties. So no, we cannot afford to produce a stream model each time in which the LMC is also disrupting and changing its shape. No, the LMC is basically an NFW sphere here that is coming in, and so it's perturbing the stream. And you can replace it with a Plummer sphere. You'll get slightly different total mass, but of the same order. The changes are not huge. So we're not, in this particular model, we're not changing the shape of the mass distribution in the LMC. Even worse, we're not redistributing the mass in the Milky Way. And you know that in the response to the infall of a massive satellite, the massive satellite will experience dynamical friction. And for it to experience dynamical friction, it means that the matter in the host galaxy needs to be redistributed, right? And so the Milky Way's dark matter distribution will change shape as well as a result of this interaction. So we explored this, and it does have some effect, but this effect is not as huge as the primary effect of just the deflection of the stream by this gigantic piece of matter.
Going back a couple of slides, did the LMC actually truncate the stream
It has not truncated. It's basically just dragged it away from its original motion. So it's just pulled, you know, half of the stream off to the side.
Could you go to the slide where it showed how close the stars went to the LMC?
Yeah.
That one.
Yeah.
So there aren't any black dots of stars in the stream at the cusp.
No, there are not. Yeah, you're right.
Is that because there weren't any in the first place, or did they get...
You may well be right. I see where you're getting at. Yes, you may be right that was a strong interaction, and that part of the stream has been, you know, deflected or disrupted. And so that's why we have difficulties of observing that portion of the stream. I agree. But we don't have the stars in the stream that experience the closest approach. Absolutely right.
And can you test this against other streams?
Yes, and that's what I'm going to tell you later about. So I'm just going to go quickly to one important point. And that important point is that if you now look at the what happens with the Milky Way as the satellite falls in. What I said is that our model is very simple. However, it has one extra degree of freedom, which is extremely important. And it's the ability of the Milky Way to respond to the interaction. The Milky Way is being pulled by the LMC, just as the LMC is being pulled by the Milky Way. So the Milky Way is experiencing a reflex motion. And you can see this acquired velocity shown in the bottom panel, right, as a function of look back time, right? So it's very quickly acquired 40 kilometers or so due to the infall of the LMC and LMC yanking the Milky Way. But now if you okay, that's good. But of course, the Milky Way is not a solid body. It's a giant thing, right? It's a distribution, pretty fluffy. You know, all galaxies are fluffy. They're basically just extremely empty, very, very low density agglomerations of stars, right? And so this fluffy thing cannot respond to being pulled, being yanked by the LMC as one thing. And so that's illustrated in the top panel, where we're showing kind of the size of the circular orbit in the Milky Way as a function of the velocity with which this the orbit is moving, right? So, or the orbital timescale on the orbit and its size, right? And so the orbital timescales for circular orbits, you know, beyond 30 kiloparsecs or so, they start to become too long, right? So here, the circular orbit is of order of 1 giga-year orbital period. What it means is that the stars on circular orbits of this size, or the stars at the distances from the Milky Way center, or beyond that, they won't be able to catch up with the Milky Way being pulled by the LMC. So what it means is that the Milky Way is decoupling now. The inner parts that where the orbital periods are shorter, where stars move fast enough to respond to the Milky Way being moved, they will move together with the Milky Way as it being young. The stars at distances beyond 30 or 40 kiloparsecs, they are moving too slow and they will decouple. They will be left behind. So it's like pulling some honey out of a honey jar. You can grab some and some of it will be moving with your spoon, right? But the honey outside of the spoon will slowly decouple and kind of fall back into the jar. So something similar is happening here, because the Milky Way is not a solid object. So Milky Way is really being reformed by this LMC's impact. And so the most striking confirmation to all of this can actually be seen in the Sagittarius stream data. I don't have as much time. I can maybe summarize to you guys, depending, I don't want to kind of drag in this on, but there is something very exciting about the Sagittarius stream that I wanted to highlight. In the Sagittarius stream, there are two things. It's even longer, it has more stars, so all the measurements that you can do with Gaia now are even more precise. So you're getting to see even more subtle effects here, right? That's number one. Second, is that no stars in the Sagittarius stream have actually gone close to the LMC. Okay, that's another important thing. So in the orphan stream, the LMC comes relatively close, right? You said we don't have stars that were, you know, at 10 kiloparsecs from the LMC. That's fine, because the LMC's tidal radius is probably, you know, 20 kiloparsecs. So even stars, you know, at 20 kiloparsecs from the LMC will be perturbed quite strongly, right? But for the Sagittarius stream, there are no stars that get as close to the LMC as in the orphan stream. And yet we see a gigantic, very strong perturbation of the Sagittarius stream. And again, you can, using Gaia, you can produce extremely clean samples of stream member stars, right? And that selection is not particularly important for this talk, but you can appreciate that once we've done all the cuts on the photometry, proper motion, distance of the stream stars, we end up with the stream member distribution here. And you can see that there's very little contamination from the galactic background, especially when you look away from the galactic plane, the contamination is, you know, few percent. And that's really precious and important in this experiment. And what this experiment immediately shows you, once you've done the selection, you can do exactly the same thing which I've just explained with the orphan stream. You can calculate the stream direction and the direction of stream motion. And that's shown in the bottom left part. The other panels show different projections of the stream members, you know, in distance, velocity, and so on and so forth. But the bottom left shows again the mismatch between the stream direction, which is the dashed line, and the velocity of the stars in the stream, which is the red band, right? And you can see that maybe here there is some offset you can reconcile in the trailing arm of the stream. So the progenitor is here. This is trailing part of the stream, and this is leading part of the stream. But it's impossible, or very difficult, to reconcile this mismatch in the leading stream, right? So the leading stream, or perhaps the whole stream, there is a mismatch between the stream direction and in the stream motion. So very similar to the Milky Way. And so what we've done here, we let our Milky Way to be as flexible as you want. We have a dark matter halo that's changing shape and the orientation. We have a very flexible radial density profile, everything, like all the stops been pulled, right? So you can see that you can explain all the data in the stream, right? The model goes through for all the projections of the stream very beautifully, velocity, distances, so on and so forth. But when you focus on the stream motion misalignment, you don't get any misalignment. You know, the motion of the stream is aligned with the stream direction, right? And that's when you realize that, you know, this complicated, sophisticated, flexible potential is not actually doing a good job. And so you have to put a perturber in, and that perturber is, of course, the LMC. And so now you have to stop me, guys, when you run out of patience. But the point of the story here is that this misalignment of the Sagittarius stream is now for one particular reason, because the Milky Way has moved, right? So it's not the stream being deflected by the LMC. There is some action of the LMC overall, but the principal reason for the stream to be misaligned is the fact that the Milky Way had to move in response to the LMC infall, right? So our models only work if we let the Milky Way move. And here again, I'm showing how much it moves, right? So this is displacement as a function of time in kiloparsecs, and then velocity, and then acceleration. And you can see it's a recent interaction, and only some particular dimensions of the Milky Way's velocity changed drastically as a result of interaction with the LMC, right? And here is just going back to the mechanics of these streams and showing you again something that I started with, and that's the relative energy, relative angular momentum, right? So the formation of this bow tie, right? And so you have to look at the right-hand side panel and see that this is our model in fixed gravitational potential. This is the ellipse corresponding to the progenitor. This is one leading arm bow tie. And here they should be the second half of the bow tie, but the bit of it is missing because we're missing high energy stars in the data that are too far in the trailing arm, move too far in the trailing arm and are not part of our sample. So we apply the same cut to the Mach stream model. So they're missing here. That's why this portion empty, right? So that's what would happen if the stream was in the gravitational potential of the fixed Milky Way, right? So the data, thanks to Gaia, we can now calculate the energies and angular momentum. The data looks like this. You can see that the part of the bow tie corresponding to the lead-in has moved up, and part of the bow tie that's corresponding to the trailing is moved down, right? So something completely rearranged these particles in the stream, right? These are gigantic perturbations, right? And this rearrangement happens not only or not solely due to, or not mainly due to the LMC's perturbation, but because the Milky Way itself moves in the response to the LMC's infall. So this is a quick cartoon of showing what happens to the stream, right? So there is a star on a circular orbit around the center of the galaxy, and the center of the galaxy is shown by this red plus sign, and you can see that as LMC falls in, the Milky Way itself is moving, right? And that extra force creates, right? So now it's a non-inertial reference frame, right? So it gets quite messy. And as a result of that, the stream is perturbed in a way that is very recognizable, actually, right? So there is no other way of explaining this. These perturbations are of such amplitude that they're really easily recognizable. But the last, I think, gorgeous thing about all of this, right? So, okay, so these conclusion slides are about the LMC, right? LMC is now the elephant in the room, which we cannot ignore. It's a very massive perturber that will affect the dynamics of all tracers in our galaxy. And we see it affecting drastically the dynamics of the stream, right? But the beautiful thing is that if you know that that's the missing ingredient, right? That we've been struggling to model these streams for a while, especially Sagittarius, but now we know what the missing ingredient is. You can actually, because the data is so numerous and so beautiful, you can actually reconstruct the 3D shape of the dark matter halo of our galaxy. And I don't have time to talk to you about this now, but I will happily answer your questions. And here I'm just kind of giving a preview slide of what I mean by that. And the top panels show the reconstruction of dark matter halo if you don't put this LMC infalling component in, and you'll get one shape, very, very striking twist in the isodensity contours. However, it would be completely wrong, because once you've accounted for the LMC, you'll get a very different shape. But nonetheless, even in the presence of the LMC, our dark matter halo doesn't want to be spherical. We get a particular shape, and it's a triaxial shape. And this shape is also evolving with radius, because in the inner parts of the galaxy, our dark matter halo is aligned with the disk, as we see in all the computer simulations of the formation of the Milky Way. And we then allow it to evolve away from this alignment with the disk at larger distances from the galactic center. And so this shape comes out of this modeling exercise, and it's the first very direct measurement of the shape of the dark matter halo of our galaxy. This is still quite wobbly. It's not very well constrained yet. I mean, we're getting some constraints, but what is better constrained is the overall radial density profile. So we measure in mass within this stream's extent, right? And as I told you, the stream extends out to 100 kiloparsecs. This is probably more than a half of our virial radius, right? And we get in a very precise measurements of the mass there. And it's actually not that high. It's only just under 6 × 10⁻¹⁰ within 100 kiloparsecs. So Milky Way is not very massive galaxy. And I leave you with this beautiful image from the paper by Nico Gravita Camargo, who's also looking at the infall of the LMC, but focusing in particular on what's happening with the dark matter density in the Milky Way, how it's being redistributed, pulled, and reshaped by the Milky Way responding to the infall of the LMC. So I stop here.
Okay, great. Thanks, Vasily. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause.
Thank you, guys.